Professor Stephen Schlosser is a member of the Society of Jesus and an associate professor of history at Boston College, where he's taught since 1999. He specializes in late modern French cultural history, with a special interest in the intersections between Catholicism and various modernisms. His PhD in history and humanities is from Stanford University. Professor Schlosser is the author of the prize-winning book, Jazz Age Catholicism, Mystic Modernism in Postwar Paris, 1919 to 1933. And most recently, the editor of Mystic Mask, Semblance and Reality in George Rouault, 1871 to 1958, a very impressive 600-page collection of 34 essays that serves as a catalog for the major exhibit that he has curated at the McMullen Museum of Art here at Boston College. The exhibit was highly praised in the Boston Globe recently, and of course, we heartily encourage you all to visit that exhibition before it closes on December 7th. And you can also download the audio tour of that exhibition from our website and from the museum's website as well, if you'd like to hear that before you make your way over there. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you here, and Professor Schlosser's topic for today is Georges Rouault's Epistemological Modesty.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And as I understand it, I'm supposed to talk about 20 minutes and then entertain any questions or commentary, and so since I don't always, you know, have a good internal clock, Eric should feel free to just stop me at that point. All right. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is offer a couple thoughts on the term of epistemological modesty. A couple of friends of mine had said, "Hey, where'd you get that?" And I stole it completely. I can't own it. It's from some lectures, undergraduate lectures that Keith Baker had given at Stanford when I was a graduate student there. I'd sit in on them so that I could actually take his lectures and reproduce them, and that's what I do here. And I can't remember if it was on Voltaire or Montaigne, but it was on one of those two on either side of the Scientific Revolution. If the Scientific Revolution is epistemological immodesty, then it was a counter-Renaissance, but it also might have been about Voltaire. And I Googled it just to see whether there was other usage of it, and Peter Berger used it in 1997 in an article in the Christian Century. So I don't know. It seems to have been floating out there, but I love it, and I've used it ever since in the history core that I teach. And in the core, basically, I do the history of modernity. People who are modest and people who are immodest about their knowledge claims. And it was really cute this summer. There was an article in the Times about how the universe is made up of, I don't know, I'm not a scientist at all. Let's say 80% dark matter, and scientists cannot explain 80% of the universe. And this kid wrote me, and she put, sounds like epistemological modesty to me. So I love the way that they've taken this in. The second point that I wanted to make was, as Eric had said, that I'm on that committee, and I wanted to relate this idea to ways of knowing in the Catholic Intellectual Tradition Initiative. And I think we can situate Rouault within the largest possible terms by seeing him maybe as a refreshing look at religion as being basically a subversion of our customary drift towards certitude. I think that Rouault sort of overturns recent preconceptions, because at least since about 1980, I think religion tends to be thought of as certitude. Pope Paul VI died in 1979, was replaced by John Paul II, and American evangelicalism obviously rose as well in the 1980s. And religion has come to be seen as something very certain in terms of, say, abortion, stem cells, gay marriage, and so on. You know, Rouault belongs to a different time. In Protestantism, we think of Karl Barth and Reinhold Niebuhr and the Protestant principle of Tillich. And for them, the belief in transcendence is a radical delegitimation of the world, something we've sort of forgotten. In Roman Catholicism of the 40s and 50s, just to name a couple of the folks that I study and teach in Catholic revivalism, Graham Greene and Flannery O'Connor, you can be sure that appearances are always deceptive, that our accepted hierarchies are always the inverse of the way the world ought to be. And it takes an enormous amount of violence for us to be converted to a right way of seeing. And if you think of those particular characters, that is where Rouault is located, especially in the 40s and the 50s. So as I think about the Catholic intellectual tradition here at Boston College, that whole initiative, I really wonder whether we could see George Rouault as being symbolic of the university as a place of profound, that preserves profound skepticism and allows us to be a place of radical delegitimation of the world. Okay, now a word about the title, Mystic Mass, Semblance, and Reality. It's a play on Catholic sacramentalism. And it's meant to be subversive that way, in the sense that in the sacraments, the reality, the res, which is the thing, is not what we see. I remember when I was in divinity school and Peter Fink, a New York Jesuit, taught us sacraments, and he was taught about transubstantiation. He said, you know, this is a word that's useless today, because for us, substance is what we see, what we touch, what we feel. For the medievals, it's none of that. It's what we don't see. It's what we can't touch. It's that other thing. The semblance, meanwhile, which is all those things, we see it, we touch it, we feel it, we can weigh it. The semblance is the sign, but it's not the reality. So you can see that it's already built in here. Appearances that deceive and the need to go beyond in order to see things that are not seen. Okay, so those are the first 3 points I wanted to make. Now, the sources of Rouault's vision. I didn't really intend this to happen. I wanted to go with Mass because Rouault is a chapter in my book that was my dissertation, and reviewers at the time used the word mask to describe his work, and that's how I started out. But once I jumped into Rouault research, I was shocked at how literary and literate he was. Guy read everything. He's incredibly precocious. And then another thing happened. In addition to researching a lot of the stuff that he wrote and that he read, because of the Boston Public Library's collection, which is phenomenal, it has 5 of his folios. They are illustrated books. And so what we see is that Rouault not only read a lot, but he was usually illustrating works of literature. And so something that I hadn't realized, because we think of him as a painter in the United States, because he was largely bought after 1931, is that most of his energy was spent doing graphic work, illustrating words. So that union of text and image in Rouault came as a surprise to me. Well, so let me give just 3 sources. There are many, but 3 that will give us a sense of what I'm talking about. When you go to the exhibition, and I hope you either have or will, you'll notice that right at the beginning we put realism. It's because Rouault was born in a slum, Belleville at the time, and in the commune, and so he's immersed in that realist world, that world is very critical of bourgeois society and of received traditions in art, say classicism and the romantics. Well, he was also precocious as a kid, and he was reading Voltaire at the age of 5 and 6, and Balzac and so on. And his grandfather was showing him Little Prince of Corbeil and Manet and Daumier. And when we think of Voltaire, we think of someone who's very nasty and sarcastic, and I don't deny that he was a little bit of a scoundrel. But, you know, his extreme realism and skepticism was aimed at alleviating suffering. And so in the introduction, here's a quotation that I have from Voltaire's preface to his poem on the Lisbon disaster, you know, this earthquake that ended up in a tsunami and destroyed Lisbon, and really shocked Voltaire into writing his poem on attacking Alexander Pope, whatever is good. So, Voltaire writes, being acutely aware of the miseries of humankind, the author of this poem, Voltaire, raises his voice against the improper use to which this ancient axiom, all is well, can be put. He makes his own that dreadful and even more ancient truth acknowledged by all human beings that, quote, evil is loose on the earth, end quote. He maintains that the saying, all is well, taken in an absolute sense and without any hope for a future life, is nothing but an insult to the sufferings of our lives. Voltaire has a very moral edge to him. And this moral edge, which is equally vicious in Rouault, as I think you might see in his first caricatures, which we have downstairs, is not simply there as a deconstruction, although it is. It's there to say that the surface realities that we see are somehow perverse. There's a very intimate connection between Voltaire and Flannery O'Connor, I think. So, my first point would be in his sources. As a young person, as a realist, immersed in that realist world, he has a realist critique of society. Second, he went to study at the studio of Gustave Moreau, the symbolist, and there he imbibed that symbolist world, especially from Baudelaire, whose Flowers of Evil he kept on his bedside table through the rest of his life. And for Baudelaire, if you notice poem correspondences from the Flowers of Evil, the world is a forest of trees. A forest of symbols. I personally have always thought of Baudelaire as kind of a secular sacramentalist, in the sense that what we see in the world is a forest of symbols that can only suggest or point beyond themselves to realities which we can't see. You may know that Rouault tried twice to illustrate the whole Flowers of Evil. We have both in the exhibition, the black and white series from the 1920s and some of the color ones from the 1930s. Along with Baudelaire and the actual symbolists, Gustave Moreau introduced Rouault to Pascal. The Rouault archives actually have this scribbled on a little piece of paper. It's really kind of touching because it's Moreau who scribbled it, and he sent it to Rouault from Avignon. He had cancer of the throat, and he would die from that, from smoking. Made Rouault promise he would never smoke, which he never did. Rouault would eventually have to go to Avignon to get cured of his nervous breakdown after the death of Moreau. So anyway, many different layers of poignancy. But anyway, here's what Moreau had scribbled to him from Pascal. Human knowledge is like a sphere which will grow without ceasing as it increases its volume, increasing the number of contact points with the unknown. So you can see that for Pascal, we know this much, but as human knowledge grows, what Moreau is saying is, unlike the positivists who believe that we will keep increasing our knowledge and one day science will know everything, what happens is that it grows to the point where it makes contact with the unknown. Right? And so ironically, as opposed to the positivists, increases in knowledge will lead to mystery. And then I go on, but I quote this part from Pascal, which is a very famous passage from the Pensée, and I think it underlines many of the works that you see in the exhibition. This is Pascal. This is our true state. It is what makes us incapable of certain knowledge or absolute ignorance. We float on a vast ocean, ever uncertain and adrift, blown this way or that. Whenever we think we have some point to which we can cling and fasten ourselves, it shakes free and leaves us behind. And if we follow it, it eludes our grasp, slides away, and escapes forever. Nothing stays still for us. Actually, I just have to say that. When I was researching this project, the Buddhist sense in Pascal, which I'd never noticed, really struck me. Nothing stays still for us. This is our natural condition, and yet the one farthest from our inclination. We burn with desire to find firm ground and an ultimate secure base on which to build a tower reaching up to the infinite. But our whole foundation cracks, and the earth opens up into abysses. Let us therefore not seek certainty and stability. Our reason is always deceived by inconstant appearances, for nothing can affix the finite between the two infinites of being and nothingness that both enclose and escape it. Very beautiful. Well, Pascal applies this to judges, and you notice how many judges and lawyers there are in Rouen. You know, part of this is that he's copying Daumier, and that's why we have one of Daumier's Jean de Justice right at the very beginning. A lawyer has his nose up in the air, and then he has the widow and her semi-orphaned child there, and he says, well, it's true you lost your case, but you must have enjoyed listening to me plead it. This is very typical of Daumier's many, many satirical caricatures of both judges and lawyers. It comes partly from there, but when you look at Rouleau's own representations of judges, and I have here, they're in the hallway, by the way, but these are inflated photographs from the Rouleau archives of these outlandishly decked out judges. The French have a flair for clothing. Yes, it looks outlandish, but there is a deeper point, and this is also Pascal and de Poncé, because you have to remember that his father was also a judge. A little, I think, Freudian, Oedipal thing there. Our magistrates have well understood this mystery. Their red robes, the ermine in which they wrap themselves like furry cats, the palaces in which they administer justice, the fleur-de-lis, and all such stately apparatus, were truly necessary. If physicians did not have gowns and slippers, if learned doctors did not have square caps and robes four times too large, they would never have duped the world, which cannot resist so original a display. If they possessed true justice, they would have no need of square caps. The majesty of the sciences would command enough respect by itself. But having only imaginary knowledge, they must take up those vain tools that strike the imagination to which they must appeal. And in this way they do, in fact, inspire respect, for we cannot even see a lawyer in cap and gown without forming a favorable opinion of his ability. Rouleau himself wrote this in 1926. Many people accused him of being too nasty. If I made such lamentable figures of the judges, it was because I no doubt revealed the anguish I feel at the sight of a human being who has to judge other men. If it so happened that I confused the head of the judge with that of the prisoner, this error merely betrayed my own confusion. I cannot condemn the judges themselves. Okay, so that's brief, but I hope that you can see that there are many literary sources, and these just are a few, of this idea that, and from both realist and extreme symbolist perspectives, as well as a Golden Age Christian like Pascal, of the way in which our senses deceive us. Okay, let me run through very quickly several motifs that you find in all of Rouleau's work and just suggest how they fit into this particular paradigm. So I've already talked about judges and lawyers, and it is the act of judgment and the difficulty that human beings have with the act of judgment that's at stake there. Christ mocked. It's very interesting. There are crucifixions, but on the whole, Rouleau uses the figure of Christ mocked, which actually comes from the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance. It's that moment at which Christ gets a robe, a crown of thorns, a scepter of reeds, and they say, all hail. It's a play within a play within a play. They don't realize that they're saying the truth. They are judged by their incapacity to make the correct judgment in this moment. And you notice down in the basement, the wild, absolutely wild Christ head is, in fact, a Christ mocked. It is not the head of Christ as the Chrysler Museum had it, but as the catalogue resume has it, it is Christmont. Next to it is its pair, which is the two prostitutes. They are meant to be the same, Christ and the prostitutes. They both dress up and they perform for others. When I gave a little chat the other night to the honors students, Lisa Cahill asked a wonderful question. And she said, well, how are these distinguished from some of these other characters? It's that they know themselves to be dressed up. Rouault presumes that we all wear masks and that we all play in a mask, right, in that sense, this masked play slash musical. But some know we are masked and others do not know that. And this is the division between his protagonists and his antagonists. The clown, well, obviously, this is at the very center. And Rouault has a very powerful personal experience in 1905, where he sees an old clown, and he, there's a long passage in which he says, I suddenly realize that we are all dressed in these glittering costumes. If you have a chance to look at or buy the catalog, three essays in particular that I would really recommend. Lou Roberts' essay on prostitutes and this dressing up and performing. Margaret Miles' essay on self-deception. And Paul Brynäs of our own history department, on Freud, the science of self-knowledge, and self-knowledge as an infinite regress. I had asked Paul to do this because we were talking about the whore with rue-colored hair, 1908, and Paul said, oh my gosh, 1908, that is Freud's, and I'm forgetting what it is, but it's something. And I said, Paul, you know, I just don't think anyone has ever situated Rouault in that world of being obsessed with self-knowledge. So I strongly recommend that particular essay. The Slave and the King. Slaves and kings, that combination we find in Dostoevsky, in Voltaire, but especially in Alfred Jarry. And we have the Ubu series upstairs. It's modeled on Jarry. Jody Blake is speaking today at 4:30, if you can make it, in Dublin 101, on Alfred Jarry and the Ubu. And you get Rouault's love, interestingly, for that kind of absurdist critique. Wanderers, I think you can tell from what I read in Pascal, that to be stable is to be self-deluded. And to be always wandering is a good thing. That's biblical. It's very Veronica, and you notice Veronica's veil is everywhere. She meets Christ on a road. It's very Thomas Aquinas. Presumption is staying still, whereas hope is never too sure. And it's Pascal. In this regard, I'd really recommend Roberto Goizueta's essay in here. It's just terrific. And it's about movement and stasis. As Rouault gets into the 1930s, you notice how incredibly anti-positivist he becomes. And he becomes highly critical of a world of what he calls weight and measure, and that there is this unseen world. And that would take us really far astray. But you notice the entire upstairs is this world of ideals. The last piece I wanted to talk about is Notre Dame de la Fin des Terres. She's in the basement there. The painted is upstairs. You know, this took me forever, but I just thank God for Google. Notre Dame de la Fin des Terres is actually, and you may know this, it's actually a shrine on the Atlantic. A lot of Rouault's titles are so cryptic, it takes us forever. And it is now on UNESCO's Patrimony of the Human Race list. 10th century, originally a little basilica, then it becomes a monastery. It's where Veronica allegedly came from the Middle East. She settled there, she preached, she died. It was sanded over, and then they didn't know it was there, and then the sands went away, and then they knew it was there, and then it got sanded over. And it was very difficult because I could not figure out this verb, ensabler. I mean, we don't really have that word, to sand over a basilica. And then in the 1860s, with the huge drive to establish tourist destinations, it was ensabler. So it was, they took the sand away, and now you can go to Notre Dame of the end of the earth. Rouen has a poem about it, and you see it downstairs. He loves this because it doesn't, whether it is sanded over or not, she is still there. Whether you can actually see it or not is not what's ultimately important. I want to conclude with this from Norman Bryson, who teaches over at Harvard. And he's commenting on George Didi Uberman, who's talking about the shroud and Veronica's veil, and asking what it presents, what problems it presents for representation. You'll notice in our exhibition that, you know, we got about 18 faces of Christ. They are two-dimensional, they're flat, they're neo-primitivist. Yes, they are Christ, but yes, because of their hieratic, flat nature, they resist any naturalist representation. And I think this goes to the heart of what Rouleau is doing here. So this is Norman Bryson talking about Fra Angelico, but it also applies here. Theologically, the picture insists on nascience. Its God is truly other, unknowable, unrepresentable. And in the face of that unknowability, the picture voids itself as a representation. It sacrifices itself. It hollows itself out. The insistence on making a representation that abjures its own powers of narrative and optical resolution corresponds to a whole doctrine of sacred ignorance. I love that line. A whole doctrine of sacred ignorance. God's presence is felt and known in the failure of representation, not its success. God's presence is felt and known in the failure of representation, not its success. To me, this is the sort of theological edge that I would associate with the epistemological modesty. Okay, so almost under the wire, and
terrific.